These are life skills that hopefully my people can use these in any relationship. And when you use these skills in your life, you will find that there's more and more successful outcomes in your relationship, whether you're a salesperson, a physician, a Stevens minister, a pastor, a therapist, a mom and dad. You know, these are really core skills of relationships. So let's get into those. And we wanted to start with a little bit of research. Some research psychologists were looking at, with all the different theories of counseling, there's over 600, probably going on 700 now, different ways of theories of how do you try to help people. They looked at all the outcome studies, you know, comparing this school of thought with this school of thought and which works. And then they do this factor analysis. They take all of these studies, hundreds of studies, trying to figure out what is the best theory to practice when you're trying to help somebody. And they took all these studies and then they do a multi-factor analysis. They came up with four basic qualities, important factors that contribute to people getting better, whether there's depression, whether there's just a grief issue, anxiety, whatever. There's four factors that are key. And it really has helped the helping fields to realize that, okay, we need to have practices that draw on these four factors. If you do, it's probably going to be a successful outcome for the person seeking the help. So, get you guys involved. The four basic factors are, number one, the content, which would be what you say as a helper. What you know, your experience, maybe your theory, your training, okay? So it's the content of what you say, kind of the advice, the theory that you have, that you can give, and the knowledge to the person. And then there's the confidence of the seeker, the one that's looking for the help, and their hope that because they're coming to you, they're going to talk to you, they're going to get better. So there's that hope and that confidence that, boy, this relationship's going to help me. I'm going to counseling now, or I'm going to the alcohol treatment program. I'm going to get better. There's a hope there, okay? And then there is the nature of the relationship between this helper and the seeker, okay? Their relationship, the nature of that, if it's caring, if the person needing the help sees that this is a person that is helpful, they have a good relationship with me, they understand me, they know what I want to work on, those kind of things. That's another important factor. So what's happening in that relationship? The quality of that relationship is a factor. And finally, the context in which the person is living. You know, let's say I talk with you as a counselor or a Stevens minister for an hour. Well, you have 167 other hours between sessions, right? In a week, 168. And all those things that happen to you, the people that you meet, the things that happen at work, your special needs child has another crisis, all of that is the context. And it turns out this is another important factor to pay attention to and has an effect on the outcome of this helping relationship. Does it make sense to you? Define those? So if we had 100%, what are your guesses? What do you think would be the percentages here? Think for a minute. How would you, maybe it'd be 25, 25, 25, 25, 100%. Because they, when they did the statistics, they actually got the percentage of how much each factor would influence the outcome of the helping relationship. So what do you think? What do you think would be, let's go with the least. What do you think would be the, have the lowest percentage? Now, they're all important, that's for sure. But
content.
Content? Okay. Yeah.
Not text. Content.
Content, right. Exactly right. It's about 15%. And this was shocking and somewhat humbling to people that have spent years studying counseling therapy, getting their doctorates, because it's important. That's a lot, but it's not all. What it's really going to do here. What would be next, do you think? Turns out that the confidence factor's got a high percentage too. Just having hope, engendering hope, that we can, you know, something better's going to happen. I'm going to improve. I've made a step of action. That's 15%. So those are 30% of the factors. You know, 30% of the outcome right there. The carrot, turns out, equals that 30%. It's a big factor in all of this. And then, of course, you're adding real quick.
40.
Thank you. I'm going to put 45. So these two are 70%. And this is why I think we need to remember this, whether we're professional helpers or not, as in any ministry you're doing in your church, as a Stevens minister or a lay helper, you can learn to key into these things, especially the content. What's happening with the person's life? How is that affecting them? I'll never forget a quick example. When I was thinking about Upper Arlington Lutheran, I was a minister of counseling there, and this woman came in, and she was very depressed, and we started to work on her depression, and weren't making a lot of progress. It was just a little bit at a time, and then one session she came in, this woman looked totally transformed. She dressed different. Her affect was different. You know, I could tell she's not depressed. It's the first time I've seen her. I was a young therapist, really full of myself, and I thought, well, what have I done? Just look at this magnificent transformation. I said, hey, thank you, Lord. I'm in the right field. She sits down and says, well, tell me a little bit about how you're feeling. Oh, I'm not depressed anymore. I feel so much better. And she says, I'm pregnant. Now, that was not an intervention. But, you know, that context can really make a difference. And what we need to learn in helping people, how do we tap into that? How do we listen for that? Amplify the good things that are happening or the little changes that are happening? Or how do we help build that? For instance, in alcohol and drug, when people first come in, they have to make a lifestyle changes, many of them. One of them is to try to change their social network. Try to move away from the people that are using and abusing the chemicals and try to start reestablishing relationships with people that are going to support them in their goals of sobriety. So the context is really key. And then the caring relationship. How do you listen? How are you engaged with that person? And this is really based on how the seeker is rating you as a helper, how well they think that you're listening and how well they think you're understanding. Another research showed a counselor, a panel of experts were observing through a one-way mirror a counselor and a person trying to get help, and they would rate how well the counselor was doing. Then they had the seeker rate how his counselor or her counselor was doing. And then they would take those ratings and correlate them to how successful, based on certain behaviors and changes that actually happened in that. By far, the best judge was the helper or the seeker. They knew what helped them most. This is what we found in the research with our parents. They really know what helps, what they need, what's going to help them. And we had no idea some of the things that they've come up with and that worked for them. And again, they were frustrated in that when they went to specialists and in the medical community, they were not often listened to. It was kind of a hierarchical system. This is what you need to do, or this is what you'll do with your child. And it wasn't always connected with what they were living with and what was working for them. So that caring relationship's real key. Of course, engendering the hope, being a place of hope, a relationship of hope is really important. And certainly, there's some of what you know is real important. You may know some scripture that could help, or you may know a certain way of thinking or of listening that might be helpful to them, or something about their particular problem that could be helpful if they, when they ask for it. And that's the other thing we found in the research, Gary mentioned it, that the parents really, one of the top stressors is receiving unsolicited advice from other people. That was extremely stressful for the families. So we have to be careful with that, but that can be powerful. Okay, any questions about that research? So where this leads us to is what we're going to talk about, which are these GRU skills. Genuine respect, empathy, and warmth. These skills are, like I said, cross-cultural. They're very basically human relationship skills. And if you're good at them, you're going to have some healthy relationships in your life. You're going to have healing relationships in your life, whoever it is you're with, anytime. And it's interesting, I was just reading some recent kind of clever research where they wired up college students to a recorder, and then they gave them time to go out on the campus and talk and just be in their relationship. And they were looking to find people that would talk more than the weather or a chat. They would get deeper into the conversation with the other person, really some meaningful conversations. And then they had these students take a happiness test or scale or satisfaction of life scale. They found that the students that went deeper in conversations, had meaningful socialization with other people in their relationships, had much higher scores on the happiness and life satisfaction. So not only does this help other people for you to be this way and express these skills, but it'll help you. You'll probably be happier. Mm-hmm. In fact, also just physically listening with some of these, with empathy and warmth, has been shown to lower the blood pressure of both people in the interaction. So, these core skills really promote those four factors that we talked about. They allow those to happen. And that's what we want to focus on today. But the context in which we're all involved in our relationships is emotions. That is the currency of life, of human life. We're wired this way. So let's go back and look at, well, what's an emotion? And we really, and this is the class that Dale is teaching, she is an expert on this. She's a worldwide expert on this. But the emotion is A, B, C, D. There's four parts to an emotion in our lives. There's the activating event. Something comes at us. Or we have an internal event. Okay? And then we're going to react to that. Okay? With a consequential feeling. So this morning my alarm went off at 6:30. I had it all planned how I would get here. That'd be enough time, you know, whatever I was going to do. Hit it. Next thing I know, it's 20 after 7. That woke me up. You know, that was an activating event. Okay, I had a startle response, kind of a feeling of anxiety. Oh, I got to get going here and be late. How am I going to get through everything? Take care of the dog, all that. So. There's an event, we feel a feeling, happy, sad, glad, mad, something like that. And then there's a decisive behavior. I do something. I got out of bed, you know. We act, okay? We can observe what the behavior is. But the key part, and these are all part of an emotion, of our emotional life. But the key part is this belief part. Because what really happens, even though it happens so quickly, is the activating event is filtered through the belief. What I'm thinking, my perceptions, my memory, my self-talk, what am I saying to myself, right? That's all in that belief system. And then that affects how I'm feeling and what I'm going to do. So, in a way, no one can make me feel a certain way. It's up to me, my belief system. And what happens in our beliefs as we go through life and have different experiences, some of these beliefs are irrational. They're not really based in objective reality. They don't help me with myself growing, or they get me in trouble with other people. But we keep using them because we believe they're true, but they're not. So maybe a belief would be, well, one in the addiction, for folks that are struggling with the disease of addiction, it's usually a core belief is, if you really knew who I was, you wouldn't like me, you'd reject me. And you carry that belief, that's going to affect a lot of feelings and behavior in your life. But that probably, that's false belief. It's not true. Or you can have a rational belief, a belief that is true, based on objective reality, brings peace to you, helps you in your relationships to other people. So Gail said she's teaching this course in renewing the mind. Literally what they're working on is how to start to slow this emotion down, listen to each other, listen to yourself, and begin to change your belief system. Renewing your mind, as Paul said in Romans, don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed by a renewing of the mind. But this is the basics of life. This is the currency of our relationships. And the group skills, back to them, help you key into your ABCD, what's going on with you, and the other person's thinking, feeling. And that's what you want to listen for. Listening for that, what was the event they're talking about? What is the feeling and their action that they've described? And then I can start to hear, what's that belief behind this? What's driving this in this person? You're really going to connect with the person. So let's start with the first skill here that's key, that helps us key into the emotion, and that's genuineness. That's learning to be real, to be a real person, is to be honest with yourself, with your thoughts and feelings, and at times express those thoughts and feelings to the people around you, whether that's your child or that's your sibling or it's a friend. Most of us want to be with people that are real. You know, we don't want to guess what they're really thinking. And we, as adults, start to do that, though. We put on masks. We're not sure, you know, what this group is going to be like. What will they accept? What will they won't? Would it be okay to say this? I better, you know, we're filtering that all the time. But we're trying to look at what is really our heart and what are our thoughts? What do I really believe here? Some of us have grown up in families where, you know, you're not supposed to feel, or you just feel what the group is feeling, you know, literally. Ain't nobody happy unless mama's happy, you know. What she's feeling, we're going to be feeling, or dad's feeling, we're going to be feeling, you know. And that takes some time to then learn to think, what are my thoughts and feelings here? It might be different, and it's okay. So let's give you a chance just to practice. Genuineness is a four-step process too. You guys know this, but maybe not quite in this type of thinking about it. But first of all, you have to at least be aware, I'm thinking and feeling right now. So you know something's going on here. There's thoughts, there's feelings. But there's so much static, so much noise in our life. We get interrupted. Sometimes you literally have to stop and, all right, what's going on with Steve? You know, I can see with them, what's that? That movie saying this, this politician saying this, I'm hearing this sermon, but what is going on here? First step, what's my thoughts and feelings? Then I start to name the thoughts and feelings. Oh, okay, I feel really at home with this group, with these people, I trust them. They've always been respectful to me. I feel at peace right now. So I know my thought, I can name it, and I can say the feeling that's there. And a lot of, you know, I think this is a great exercise to start checking out, what am I feeling? I often tell people just to put a little index card one day in their pocket, and then every 2 hours just take a deep breath, get quiet, and just what have I been feeling today? I felt scared, I felt happy, I felt irritated, I felt bored, just write them down. Don't judge, just what was I feeling? And it starts to give you more access into your inner life that is driving some of your behaviors. So you think about it, you name them, then you need to acknowledge. Can I own this feeling? I shouldn't be feeling this when I'm with Gail. I shouldn't feel that feeling, you know. I better not feel that. Or I can say, you know, this is what I'm feeling. It's not right or wrong, it's just my, you know, experience. What's my belief about that? What's my thought? So it's acknowledging it, it's owning that. It's saying, this is what's going on with me, right or wrong. And usually isn't right or wrong. It's just a fact. Feelings are facts. But we have a difficult time accepting our own feelings. And the people you're listening to oftentimes are very shy or hesitant to tell you what they're really feeling unless you give them signals that it's okay, you're not going to judge them. Again, one of the biggest things we learn from the families is they have to deal with so much judgment in their life. Judgment about how their child is behaving in a certain context, judging them as parents. Very stressful. They just wanted somebody to listen and to be available in a non-judgmental way. Then genuineness starts to occur. It promotes that. So, quick example of acknowledgement from my life. It's about 35 years ago, I met this woman at Bowling Green State University, and we got to be really good friends and really got to know each other. And then, I don't know, it's about the third quarter of the year, spring quarter, the hormone time. You know, I like him, like, man, I really want to be around her. She's really a lot of fun. We just have so much in common. And we just did more and more, and I'm not sleeping at night. I'm giddy when I'm seeing her, and I just had this thought, I'll never forget it. Well, you're falling in love with her. And this other part says, no, you got your academic career, you got some other things to do. This is not the time for falling in love. You know, back and forth, back and forth. Finally, she came to me, and finally had this dear conversation. She said, I just can't not keep this to myself. I'm falling in love with you. And it scares me, but I wanted to talk about it. Oh my gosh, you know, I'm like freaking out. I'm like, okay, I got to get out of this situation. You know, I kind of shut down. And of course, she's confused. And why are you shutting down? And it took me 24 hours. I knew, but I couldn't say it. I couldn't acknowledge it. But a day later, had another talk. And I said, you know, I have the same kind of feelings. And it's a good thing we had that conversation because it's been 32 years, 33 years that we've been married. But it was hard to be genuine at that moment, to acknowledge. Do you get that? The little difference between not only naming it, but acknowledging that. So then those three parts of genuineness are all internal. If I'm thinking, what am I thinking and feeling? Then I name it. Then I acknowledge it. That's still all inside here, but at least I'm being real with myself. I'm being genuine here. I know what's going on here. The next thing is the risky part, and that's the social part, where I share with another person what I'm thinking and feeling. And that's certainly a time in the relationship where people get closer. They really start to connect, you know. And we all take that risk. So I'd like to push you a little bit and wake you up this morning. So let's go around real quickly and just say your name and what you're feeling. And I know you don't really, maybe some of you know, some of you, others you don't. But this is a group of human beings. Just try to say, I'm Steve and I'm feeling calm right now. You just did a genuineness exercise. You had to do all four of those steps and take the risk socially to do that. So genuineness is a key when you're helping and when you're trying to also talk to somebody yourself to get some help. Then there's respect. And respect is a really key aspect of healthy relationships. And it's basically having the attitude that everyone is of worth. No matter what their status in life, what they're wearing, what ethnicity they are, this is a human being that is of worth. Okay? Thank you, Mark. He's our equipment man. So, this is based in compassion, of course, in trying to understand the other person and trying not to be judgmental and respecting where they're at is where they're at right now. This is their place in life. And trying not to judge. When we start to help people, sometimes we get confused with this whole respect thing, and that many people that are talking to us, and in our own life, we often have feelings of shame, guilt, and which is the opposite of feeling respect. The more respect I have for myself, I start building self-confidence, self-esteem, I can do more things, take more risks. And so sometimes when we're working with people, it's trying to respect them to help them build up their own self-respect. I see this every day in my work when people come in the first day to their treatment, trying to get off alcohol and drugs and get sober. They have a lot of incredible amount of shame and guilt. But they come into the group and they find out that the group sees that it's not going to judge them, it's going to take them who they are right now, what they're trying to do. They often get affirmed that they're even here in that treatment center. They start to build some confidence and self-esteem, and it just literally transforms them. It's amazing. So respect is a real key. The risk of this in a helping relationship is sometimes we will take on what is really the responsibility of the seeker. You know, we take on what they need to do for themselves. So like Heidi's teaching about the golden rule. You all know what the golden rule is, right? Do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. There's also in helping a lead rule. And that is doing for others what they need to do for themselves. And it's very tempting sometimes as helpers or a helping agency to do that. Like in our research, we could have come in and said, hey, we've done the literature review. Here's some things you ought to do. Wait a minute. In some ways, that's disrespectful. We haven't even heard what these families go through, what their perspective is, what it's like in their life. And so it's better to always listen first and to clarify what kind of help does this person want from you, okay? In parenting, this is a very difficult skill to maintain that respect. So because it's a discernment between what is overwhelming me as a seeker that I need somebody to step in and help me do some things because I'm just overwhelmed. An issue that I can carry. It's my load. Paul has a great word of instruction in Galatians. He goes, bear one another's burdens and thus fulfill the law of Christ's love. Burden bearing. We're called to that. We need to bear one another's burdens. But if anyone thinks he's too good to help another person, he's fooling himself. Let each of us examine our own works, and then our reason to feel good about ourselves will be our accomplishments and not the efforts of others. Every person must carry their own load. So we need to make that discernment, and he actually used the Greek architectural terms. Burden is something that would be overwhelmed by the weight of a building. So this wall is a burden. I can't carry, this won't carry the load of this roof. Okay, but it's a nice boundary, it separates the rooms. Come back here.
That's a burden too.
But I think probably there's a beam right there where that big thing coming out, that's a load-bearing beam. That's holding up the building. You got to have that. So as a helper, we're constantly trying to be respectful by not taking somebody's load that theirs. They've got to learn how to deal with it. They've got to live with that. They've got to live with that particular solution. You don't. But we can come alongside and bear their burden, and that's where these skills come in. Listening, helping, being non-judgmental. But that's a tricky area. So learning to be respectful, there's four questions that when you're listening to people that can help you discern this and be respectful. One, well, whose problem is it? That's the question. Whose problem is it? I'm listening to this person, who is the, what's the problem, and who really will benefit from the solution, have to live with the solution. So number one, is it your problem? Second possibility, it's my problem. Third probability is it's our problem, so we both have to work on the solution together. And the fourth possibility is, well, there's really no problem. We thought there was, but as we clarified, there isn't a problem. So we want to make sure as helpers that we don't take on the loads of others. We understand, we listen, we know what that is, but we know that's their responsibility. So the lead rule violates that. It does for others what they need to do for themselves. That's disrespectful. The stone rule, the even heavier thing around your neck, is doing for others what only God can do for them. You know, starting to become omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent in your helping. You know, I have to know all the answers to help this person, you know, to really, you know, be of much good. I got to know all the answers. I've got to always be available. Well, we can't. We're human. Can't do that. So that, and but some people get drawn into that in their helping. So a little bit about respect. Any questions quickly about genuineness or respect? Thoughts? Comments? Just give you time to process. Can you still process things here? Anybody have any good jokes now? Okay. So I'll tell you, this is like the, when you're thinking about a relationship and you want to be helpful or healthy in the relationship, genuineness, respect are this big, big foundation and that always need to be part and will promote these those four factors. The genuineness, of course, you're going to think about beliefs, your own feelings, and listening to the beliefs and feelings of others. And respect, you've got to have some pretty rational beliefs so that you can be peaceful if you're trying to help and you don't feel false guilt because you haven't taken somebody's load on that's really theirs. They might have been pushing you to take it, but you've declined it. You've clarified. And a good question with respect is really, well, what do you want me to do? What do you want, after listening to somebody, what can I do to help? 80%, 85% of the time I ask this question, people will say, pray. They don't really want me to do something or give them the answer. And if they say, well, gee, I want you to do this for me, and I think, hey, that's, you have to learn how to do that. I may have to clarify and say, I can help you get there. We need to figure out how you can learn to do that. Okay? So there's the foundation, and then the next block is empathy and warmth. And these are the real listening skills of reflective listening. Warmth is non-verbally letting the other person know that you care and that you're paying attention, that you're interested in them, you want to listen. And warmth, you don't say much at all. It's all what your body's saying. You know, we have 13 muscles in our face. And we can make those muscles do a lot of different things. And we learn how to watch for those expressions on other people's faces. So when you're being warm, you have a warm expression of attentiveness, of listening. And you're also looking at the other person. You're paying attention to what their body is saying. So now, so in your relationships, let's say, Gail, let's get you up here a minute. Can you be a clay? Get a chair up here because we're going to have to put you down.
Okay.
Now she's just going to be a mold of a lump of clay. Told her that all the way down here. Now let's say that I'm going to go and talk with her. Okay. What would you start to fashion her? If you're the sculptor here, how would you fashion this body into a warm listener? What do you think?
Sit up straight.
Okay, first of all, sit up straight. You didn't say lift your head, just sit up straight. Just be a lump of clay. Just follow
her. How about lifting your head?
Lifting your head. Okay, lifting your head. Eyes are this way. What else? How about maybe arms maybe here, you know? Yeah, and maybe leaning forward, the heads up, okay? Because the posture's open, the face, she's looking at the person, she's involved with that conversation, okay? I mean, that's really the posture of being warm. It's pretty simple, but it's not always easy to remember. You've got a lot of things going through your mind and somebody wants to talk to you. Thank you. You're a great lump of clay. And we try to remember this, we often train people in solar tea. mom used to get one of these big glass jars and fill it with water, put tea bags in the summer and put it out on a picnic bench and then let it sit out there for 4 hours and make this nice mellow tea. And in a way, we're trying to do that in our relationships, because if we get too hot with people, if you think about your relationships with people, some you're really close, you're really intimate. They're more on the scale of hot, because you can share easily your intimate relationships, physically, touch, etc. On the other end of the scale is cold. You know, really cool, callous, not interested. Even attacking, okay? That is not a very effective relationship to be in for very long. It's harmful. But, you know, if one of you, when you first came in here, I've never met Lisa, she walked in here first, she was a brave one, and if I would have ran over to her and hugged her, and, oh, Lisa, we're so happy you're here, and hugged her and hung on, she's like freaking out. She's ready to go. This was the wrong workshop to come to, you know, because it's too much. It's too much too quick. So what most people are comfortable with on the scale is that warm area. That's where a lot of work gets done. Hospitality, it's really nonverbal hospitality. Churches work at trying to have a warm environment. Greeters at the door, you know, like today, there were some greeters just right here to direct you to where to go. That's an intentional warmth of an organization to do that. And we can remember to do that with solar tea. So, Gail, come up here and help me with this. So, if Gail's going to talk to me, first of all, we want to do space. That's the S in solar T. I don't want to invade her space. If I'm talking to her like this, it's going to distract her. But, you know, North America, we need about an arm's length at least. And maybe not really directly in front of her, maybe a little bit to the side. So she's kind of got, if she gets uncomfortable and needs a drink of water, she can go that way, you know. Then I want to be open. S-O, open. You know, so I can see all of what she's trying to say with her nonverbals and her verbals. Probably want to lean into the conversation. That'd be the L. Leaning in, letting her know just with my body that I'm orienting toward her. Appropriate eye contact. If I'm just looking at Gail, all right, Gail, tell me what you're thinking. You know, it's a stare down, you know, but it's appropriate eye contact. And some of us, when we're listening to Gail, we'll look up because we're kind of visual thinkers, and so we're trying to picture in her mind what she's saying. That's okay, but you bring the eyes back eventually to Gail. So appropriate eye contact, relax. The R in solar is being relaxed. You just kind of, you know, relax. When you're more relaxed, you can listen better and hear and start to think about the ABCD that she's telling you about and what might be some helpful things to say later on. So I'm relaxed. Then the T of solar T is touch. Non-possessive touch. You don't want to overwhelm the person. You want them to be safe. But what's the largest organ in the body?
Your skin.
Yeah. You know, and we communicate a lot with this. Unfortunately, in this culture now, it's become over-eroticized. But touch is very important to human beings, to babies up through adults, you know. And so I might shake her hand and hold on, it's great to see you, tell me about you, and she can't get away. That's possessive touch, that's not warm. But if I, hi, Gail, I'm Steve Griebling, and I keep my hand open, and you notice she let go when she's ready to let go, and she can get out of that touch. So I wouldn't embrace her and hold her. And even with touch, as we go through relationships, we start to have different levels of expressive warmth. Gail and I might start out as friends like this, a side-by-side hug. Later on, we know each other better, we trust each other. We might do an A-frame hug. It's not quite it. But, and then if we really trusted each other, know each other well, like we do a lot of times when Gail and I, we haven't seen each other for a while, we'll just hug you anymore. But you always leave it open. You don't, you know, you wait for that person when they're ready to pull back, then you let them go back. So think about touching your relationships with your kids, with other family members. It can be really a key part. And learning about what they're comfortable with. I know I have two sons, and I know even my daughter too. They would love to what they call hug wrestle. when they were two or three or four. They'd like to, you know, get down. I'd have to get down on the floor. They'd get me down there, and they just wanted to wrestle and roll around, and they called it hug wrestling. They didn't want me to get, but they could push me around a little bit and just play that way. The Israelites, there's an ancient wisdom they had that when a baby was born, the mother, of course, would feed the child, and then for the first night give it to the father, and the father would lay the baby on his chest like this all night, first night, create that bond. And of course, we know from neurobiological research, when babies get a lot of touch, their brains develop much better. Safe touch. Thanks a lot. So, aren't you glad you drove all the way? Touch, and then there is the environment. Watch the environment. If I'm sitting on the couch and I've got my little clicker watching the games today, and a family member walks in the room, and I can see by their face they really need to talk, if I click that thing off, that's taking care of the environment. That's setting the environment to be something that's going to be listening, attentive. And that says a lot to the other person. Oh, okay, I can talk. He's even going to shut off the football game with that whole thing. So think about the environment when you're in relationships. Does it promote listening? Can you hear them? Are they able to talk? That kind of thing, and express things. Then finally, the last one is A, accommodation. We live in a culture that, in a world that is multicultural. People come from different families. They've had different relationship experiences. They have different nonverbals. It's important to learn what works for different people and to accommodate them. Try to accommodate for the pace of the person, how much they speak, etc., the volume, how comfortable they are with touch. Try to accommodate them so they can better talk to you. And of course, this is big when we're dealing with special needs children and parents, to accommodate for what's happening in their life and how different it is for them to be warm. Okay? So that's the solar tea. Let's let's try to role play this real quick. Gail, we're just going to... Now, what I want you guys to do is to apply the solar tea. Rate me on how well I do with Gail, my friend Gail. She's going to talk to me about something in her life, a positive experience in her life. And I will listen. Now, you guys rate me on how well I do with warmth. And if I'm not doing too well, kind of make a note of what I could be maybe doing better. Okay? Good to see you, Gail. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. Right.
Yeah. Well, what's going on?
Well, I woke up last Saturday morning and I had an 80-year-old man in my bed.
Birthday, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we had a big party for Don.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had old. I heard Gary talk about old friends. The mayor was an old friend, and Don had even older friends at his party. It was really nice.
Hold on, Gail. This thing went off. This. Okay. Yeah, well, that's great. Glad you had a good party, right?
Yeah.
How's this going? Okay, what's bad? What would you like? What's
I didn't like the cell phone.
Okay, interruption, distraction.
The call.
You didn't look at her once, hardly.
Yeah, no eye contact, you know. How's she doing?
Oh, yeah, about 80-year-old man.
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to talk through this. Is he listening? And maybe this isn't the right time for Steve. She's kind of losing track of her thought. That's the power of what warmth or non-warmth can do. And, I mean, this is, it's easy. You know, intellectually this is easy. But when you, all these different relationships coming at us through the day, we start to violate the warmth stuff. You know, we're trying. But let's try this again. Gail? Good to see you. Been a while. What's up?
Well, Don turned 80 last weekend. We had a big party, right?
Yeah.
And all the kids and grandkids, so it was fun. And then his old friends, people who have known the family for, well, known family, probably since the family started, some of them in 46 years ago, and some of the friends go back 60 years because they were college buddies. So it was fun. It really was. It was just, it was precious.
Okay, any difference?
Big difference.
The space, the openness, leaning into it. And a lot of times when you listen, you can start to, you'll find your face can reflect their emotion. If it's happy or if it's sad, lets them know you're connecting. So just real little subtle things can make a big difference. Okay, thanks Gail for risking that. So then when you have the spaces of warmth, then when they pause, you could reflect back. Her thoughts and feelings. We're back to that ABCD again. We can listen for her ABCD. You guys heard her story. What was she feeling about this? What do you think her feeling was? Happiness?
Contentment.
Pride.
Okay. So you got a feeling word. What was the event?
Her
husband's 80th birthday, exactly. And she had those feelings, pride, what you guys said. What do you think was the thought or the belief that led to that feeling? She said it was a precious time. It was amazing that people that he'd known for 50 years were there to be with him. So those are some of the thoughts. So you put the thought and the feeling together. You felt blank because. That's a reflective listening statement. Gail, you felt blank because, or you're feeling blank because. So what might you say back to Gail? If she paused, what she did right then, you're listening, what would be a brief reflective phrase to summarize what she said to you? Anybody want to try it? That's good, you're thinking. Got it. Try it, Betsy.
Gail, you seem to be feeling happy because your husband had such a nice birthday party.
Yes. Perfect.
That's good.
I mean, it's simple. You just want to make a one sentence. You don't want to go on to a long analysis. So you're feeling, boy, you must have been really excited to see Don with all his friends at that birthday party. Keep it on her. So empathy is verbally reflecting back to the person their thoughts and feelings, not my thoughts and feelings. This is where the skill of genuineness helps, because as you're listening, you know, I know Don, I'm starting to have feelings in there. I've got to kind of know those, put them aside a little bit, and think, what does Gail feel? Mm-hmm. Okay, and then I say, okay, she's feeling this. It might be different than what I'm feeling. And I say her. So empathy is an exchange of the same feelings and thoughts. It's not adding to the conversation. It's not advice. It's not saying you should have felt this, or I bet you felt that. You know, it's okay, this is what you're telling me. And so when people have an empathic exchange, it's kind of back and forth like a mirror. And then you pause again when you're the listener, let them speak some more, and you try to think what's the feeling and thought next, and they pause and you reflect back in your own style, with your own tone of voice. And you try not to, you know, as you practice this, it becomes less and less a technique. It's just kind of a natural thing. It clears up to them, you're listening, and you got it. A lot of times people say, well, no, that's not quite it. Because they're starting to listen to themselves, they're trying to figure out what they're really thinking and feeling. And maybe they kind of told you a surface part, but as they hear you reflect back, they think, wait a minute, it's something different than I realized. And now you're helping somebody really explore more about their emotion, okay? Because we often don't slow that down. And this kind of listening slows the process down for the speaker. They might change a little bit. And so the empathy helps you track that change. It's like a radar, you know? You're sending the signal back. It's beep, did I hit you? You know, did I get this? And if not, they'll gently correct you, and they'll keep going because they know you're trying. If you're not warmth, and you're not hitting the reflective statement, then that's when things go south. That's when it doesn't work as well. Any questions or comments? Yeah.
Yeah. Is that then the same time? Because I got a little bit of a feeling from Gail that maybe she was feeling a little strange that she had a husband that was 80 years old.
So no, that was a joke.
But no, that's a good point. Time, really, no. But you have those thoughts because you're as you're listening, you're kind of listening to the sub story. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so then, and we've got our own stuff that comes up as we're listening. We tend to project that on other people. We have to be careful with that. That's where the, I think, unsolicited advice comes, or I'd start telling her, oh, I wish I'd have been there. Oh, I you know, I like Don so much. Did he have his golf buddy? You know, doing all that instead of letting her talk. Okay? Now, there might be time for that after she really tells her story. Then I can. So you have to be careful that as you're listening, and eventually, if you listen enough, there might be something you can add. You put together some things and summarize it in a statement that might be very helpful. The kind of, you know, I haven't packaged it that way before, but I think I am feeling this now that you say it. But you have to be, that's risky. You have to really make sure you know, you've tried a couple of empathic exchanges first to do that. But you're right, that's very honest of you, because we're thinking, okay, what's she really saying? You know, and I want to get at the truth. You want to just be cautious with that, but keep listening.
I was amazed, actually. It's hard to keep a man alive until he's 80. Especially Don. <Yeah. laughs>
Other questions, thank you. Comments about any part of it. Well, we found that, you know, our researchers really used the GRU skills. Try to be genuine, respectful, empathic, and warmth. And it was incredible then what the family members were able to say to us and the amount of information that started to flow. The question is for the camera, what can we do right in the spontaneous moment to try to be helpful?
Yeah. For me, we had a child who had special needs and gave us special trouble as well. And I had cultivated relationships with two people within our church and actually within the ministry that we all took in. And prayer, being able to have people of prayer to say, this is what's going on right now. We can process it and discuss it some other time, but I just needed prayer at that moment. And it's interesting because it, from my seekers that I'm assigned to and so on, months or years after we've ceased to be together in a regulated time, they will seek me out for quick prayer. It's just something, having somebody join you before God, who is ultimately one who can help give wisdom or whatever, is like in a moment. If you're talking about quick, I just think that is
that's one
a
resource.
Blessing.
May not always work. I think the other thing that comes to mind is quickly trying to assess, what's the person want right now?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Do they want action? Do they want instruction? They need information? Mm-hmm. Do they just want to be understood? And so you try to think, what do they want right now? Mm-hmm. And I might even quickly clarify that, you know, or state the situation again, reflect back, boy, we don't have a lot of time here, but we need to, in the long term, figure out a better process. But for now, what would be best for you? You know, or my idea is this is what we could do. Are you asking for this? Or sometimes we have to say, we're not equipped to do this. Okay. I can't give this to you. I can't take that action right now. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My question is kind of along the same line. I think I understand what you're saying because I work in the resource room at our church. And so your interactions are so fast with families.
Yeah.
and you don't want to give off the impression that you don't care.
Right.
But it's those quick drop off and pick up times, yeah. You know. And
well, and that's where the non
you care about their kids.
The nonverbal
request. I mean,
right.
Yeah. That could be.
Can I pray for you later on this afternoon? Mm-hmm.
Right.
I'll pray for you later on.
Right.
But acknowledgement and validating what they might be feeling. You know, at least they'll go away with thinking, okay, they understand. You know, they got that.
Someone understands, yeah.
So, yeah, that's a great question.